This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan in Washington. This week marks 60 years since the establishment of the State of Israel and 60 years since the surrounding Arab countries, Egypt, Lebanon, Syria, and Jordan, attacked. The first order David Ben-Gurion gave was to establish the IDF, the Israeli Defense Forces. In 1948, it was a ragtag army made up of pre-state paramilitary members, Jewish guerrillas, Holocaust survivors, and some veterans of World War II. But they managed to defeat the Arab armies and continued to defeat them in five major wars in the first 40 years of Israel's existence. The IDF is at the heart of Israeli society. National military service is compulsory for Jewish men and women, and friendships, contacts, and reputations established in the military can be important to later success in business and especially in politics. These days, many young soldiers find themselves serving in the occupied territories. Today, how service in the IDF shapes Israelis and Israel. Later in the hour, U.S. intelligence and weapons of mass destruction on the opinion page this week. We'll hear an argument that mistakes in Iraq lead to underestimations of the nuclear weapon programs in Syria and Iran. But first, the Israeli Defense Forces. If you served in the IDF, how did that experience shape you and your views? Tell us your story. Our number here in Washington is 800-989-8255. Email us, talk@npr.org, and you can also join the conversation on our blog. That's at npr.org/blogofthenation. And joining us now from the Jerusalem Capital Studios in Tel Aviv is Tamar Yaron. She's a movie director who made two films following her army service as a welfare officer in the West Bank and Gaza. Her latest is called To See If I'm Smiling. Its most recent award was a special jury prize last week given at the Hot Docs Canadian International Documentary Festival. And thanks very much for being with us today.
Thank you.
Your movie is the testimony of six female Israeli soldiers about their service. But first, let's talk about your own service, after which you made your first movie. We should also explain that women do not serve in combat, at least officially, in Israel.
Well, some of the women in the late years, some of the women do serve in as combat soldiers as well.
As well.
In the film, there's one woman who also served as a combat soldier. That's a new thing that is happening in the last years in the army.
But you believe that the experiences of the women you made your film about, obviously yourself and the other women you served with, that it tells us a great deal about what happens when people are called to serve in the occupied territories.
Yes, I think it does. I mean, part of the thing that the film is saying is that you don't really have to be in the front line, a combat soldier, in order to experience what you experience in the territories. So also if you're in the, if you're more in the side of it, like I was, that I was just a welfare person, that my job was to take care of the soldiers, even I experienced this world that is very problematic in the territories. So all the moral questions come up, and you don't really have to be in the front line fighting in order to experience these things. And you then carry them later in life with you as well.
And there's a story behind the title of your film, To See If I'm Smiling. Tell us about that.
Okay, this is the story of Meital. She served as a paramedic in the army, and she went to the army because it's compulsory, but she chose especially this role because she wanted to save lives, and she was very idealistic in that sense. And during her service, she was in many difficult situations, and then there was one situation that they brought a Palestinian body to their base. There was I don't remember the word. My English is not that.
Your English
that good,
is fine.
a battle that one Palestinian was killed, and then there was this thing of what do you do with this body? And they said, okay, you have to wash this body before you give it back to the Palestinian authorities. And then they told Meital that, okay, you're a paramedic officer, you do this job. So she did this job that was very traumatic, of course, and she wasn't prepared for. And when this thing happened again and again, you become desensitized, I think, to what is happening. And then one girl came and she said, she came with a camera, and Meital said, if you can take a picture of me. And she took a picture of herself with this Palestinian body. Now, this was a confession that she told me when I did this interview with her, and it was something that she didn't tell anybody before, and it was her big secret in life. And then we did this interview, and suddenly this thing came up, and she talked about this photograph of herself with this body, and it was something that she was very much ashamed of. I mean, if you would meet Meital, you wouldn't imagine that she was part of this situation. And then was this thing that she said, I want to see this picture because I want to see how I was then and how this could have happened. And I also want to see myself in this picture, and I want to see if I'm smiling. And that's where the name of the film comes from. So that's like one of the stories that's in the film.
And the cumulative experiences of yourself and these other women who served, their stories that you tell, being in that service in this time changes you.
Yes, definitely changes you. I mean, I don't think that you can be part of this world without discovering things about yourself that maybe you would prefer not to discover. Because as much as, I mean, I think everybody thinks of themselves or likes to think of themselves as moral people and good people. And we all went to the army just wanting to do our duty to our country and to protect our country. And then you're part of a situation that you're controlling a population. And you're saying, okay, that's what we're doing at the moment. But it's only years after that you realize what it means being a part of it. And then you also have these experiences that years later in life, you try to think, how come that was me in that situation? And it's hard to believe for you that that you were part of this situation. It doesn't fit what you think of yourself. And I know what it did to me, because for me, it was something that it was a very, very heavy burden that I carried on in my life. And it made me ask many questions, and it made me also definitely more humble. I mean, because this thing of knowing what's right, now I doubt everything, because I was in a situation that it was clear to us that we were the good guys, we're protecting the country. I served in the territories in the first Intifada. So that was, it was still, it's not like today when things are more talked about and we already know what it means. Then it wasn't that much out there. It wasn't that much talked about. And so we were just feeling that we were, you know, protecting the people who live in the territories. And that was our job. And I was just thinking of my soldiers, trying to make it as, you know, as comfortable as possible for them. Mm-hmm. And this thing of you're not thinking about the other side and the price they're paying, then that is something that you think about that a lot afterwards.
Also with us is Jeffrey Goldberg, national correspondent for The Atlantic, also a veteran of the Israeli Defense Forces. He moved from Long Island to Israel while a college student, and in the middle of the First Intifada in 1990, the Israeli army sent him to serve as a prison guard at the largest jail in the Middle East, and he joins us here in Studio 3A today. Good to have you on the program
today.
Thank
you.
And would you agree with Tamar Yarom, service changes you?
Service changes you. I think some people are not so affected by it. Some people learn good things about themselves. The ability to keep yourself moral. Those who succeed at keeping themselves moral come out of it, I think, whole and pleased with themselves. But the challenges sometimes are too much for an 18-year-old, a 19-year-old, 20-year-old to occupy a group of people who don't want to be occupied. And so, again, you know, it's interesting she mentioned the first Intifada, the first Palestinian uprising. I think now Israelis are used to this and used to talking about this. Back then, when I would go home for a weekend break and talk about either being in the territories or being in this prison, people couldn't relate to it. It was a very new experience because for 20 years, the 20 years previous or so, the Palestinians were more or less quiescent. And we believed, and many Israelis believed, that what Israel was conducting in the territories was an enlightened occupation, so-called. Turns out that there's really no such thing as an enlightened occupation. Eventually, you become coarsened and brutalized by the occupation.
I wonder, Tamar Yarom, do you think that the stories would have been significantly different if they'd been told by men or women who'd served in direct combat roles, as tank drivers or pilots?
You mean if it wasn't stories by people who served in the territories?
Mm-hmm.
I didn't understand.
Yes.
Of course. I mean, the fact that you're dealing with the population, that they're not soldiers, I mean, this is a completely different war. When you're dealing with women and you're dealing with children, then that's a different game altogether. So, Jeffrey talked about this thing of just keeping moral there. And still you can, you know, do your best to be as moral as you can, but still you have the faces of children hating you for what you represent. You represent the army that is occupying, and those faces of children, of women that hate you so much, that you know, that are suffering so much, these are faces that you then carry on with yourself later on in life. So it's a thing of your, even, I mean, you can be very moral, but you're part of an immoral situation. So that's, it's still something that I think that is difficult to deal with.
This month, Israel marks its 60th anniversary of the country, also the 60th anniversary of its army, the Israeli Defense Forces. We're talking about the experience of service in that service this hour. We'll take your calls at 800-989-8255. You can also send us your story by email, talk@npr.org. Stay with us. I'm Neil Conan. It's the Talk of the Nation from NPR News. This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan in Washington. We're talking today about the Israeli Defense Forces. Serving in the IDF is mandatory for almost all Jewish men and women in Israel over the age of 18. How does that experience shape their lives and how they view their country? 800-989-8255. Email us, talk@npr.org, and you can read what other listeners have to say on our blog at npr.org/blogofthenation. Our guests are Tamar Yarom, who served in the IDF and is the director of To See If I'm Smiling, the testimonies of six female soldiers serving in the territories. Also with us is Jeffrey Goldberg, national correspondent for The Atlantic magazine, who served in the IDF and wrote a book about it called Prisoners, A Story of Friendship and Terror, which is out in paperback. If you'd like to join us again, the number is 800-989-8255. Email talk@npr.org. Steve joins us now on the line from Boston, Massachusetts.
Good afternoon. I am an American who made Aliyah and went to Israel in the mid-90s. And I went to university, and I also went into the Army to serve my time there. And I ended up doing it with an infantry unit. And it was definitely changed my experience. I thought I had to go into the Army to help integrate me into society and to learn more about Israel on top of going to university. And sure enough, I learned much more than I thought that I would.
And when was this?
This was 97, 98, and 99 when I was there. I served full in 97 through 98.
And were you in the territories?
I was.
And we've heard people describe the experiences of varying stages of horrible. Was it for you?
When we first trained, and we trained for Southern Lebanon or trained for combat, it was different than going into a dual rotation in the territories, when then you became occupiers and seeing the Palestinians and seeing them at checkpoints or going into someone's home at night to arrest somebody. That was, for me, absolutely terrifying. I couldn't believe the extent that we were doing this, but I understood how it had to be done, especially if there were legitimate suspects who needed to be arrested. But the looks on the faces of families and you know, coming into the house in the middle of the night and arresting a son or a father or a brother, it was the look of hatred and fear on their face. We were all scared too. So it was just it definitely brought me to new levels of fear that I didn't know would be out there. And just having somebody look at me with, you know, with their eyes many times, just you can see the total fear that we wouldn't recognize here.
Jeffrey Goldberg, you went as a self-described dewy-eyed idealist to Israel. And
we all did.
And found that you were disappointed to some degree.
Well, I was disappointed, but my disappointment isn't actually fair to Israel because I had such an idealistic view, sort of a Leon Uris Exodus view of a perfect state with perfect people, that I inevitably wound up holding people to standards that no humans can be held to. It was a roller coaster for me. There were moments in the army, particularly, in which I was disappointed with Israeli society and with the behavior of the Israeli army. There were other moments in which I realized that the Israelis are holding themselves to an extraordinary standard of behavior, given the difficult circumstances. So each day would bring a new experience, and it would be a conflicting experience.
Did you find yourself disillusioned, Steve?
In the end, no. But when my initial year was up, I was very happy to be over with it. But the friendships that I made and the connections that I made with people with my fellow soldiers were, you know, are kept today, and I'm very happy of it. But would I go back and do it again? I don't know. Especially, I mean, I lucked out. I didn't have to really do anything during the Second Intifada, where everything really changed, and I didn't go back for the Second Lebanon War either. So I was still there as part of, you know, during Oslo.
Steve, go ahead.
Yeah, no, you know, it's interesting. I think many American Jews who've done this have visions of the Raid on Entebbe, the Six-Day War, and when you get there, you have to deal with the grimy reality. That you're not being turned into a commando hero, but you're being turned into essentially a police officer, policing people who don't want you policing them. And I think that's the gap, and in that gap falls your idealism.
Steve, thanks very much for the call.
Okay.
All right, bye-bye.
Bye.
Let's see if we can go to, this is Shai. Shai's with us from St. Louis.
Yes, good afternoon. Love the show.
Thank you.
Well, I was... I was pretty right radical before joining the army while I was 18, and the service itself totally changed my perspective on all this Israeli Palestinian situation, and I've seen the way they live, seen the way the repression they have, the attitude that a lot of soldiers coming to the army starting their service. It's personally, I was with a lot of hatred, and a couple of years ago, I kind of this revelation that we are the Spartans of the millennium in a way, and living in the shadows of soldiers all the time. And your father was in a soldier, and your neighbor was in a soldier. You kind of grew up to be a fighter deep down in your core, in your head, in your mind. And it's and listening to the other comment, the other caller before me, I was. Finishing the army was one of the happiest. My service was one of the happiest days in my life, and I don't think I will ever go and do that service back again.
Tamar Yarom, I think several of the women you spoke with in your film would feel the same way, that the day they left the service was a very happy one.
Yes, it was a very happy one, but then starts real life. And then what people expect of you, to go on with real life as if, okay, you did your job and then you can just go on and find a job or study and everything. And it sometimes isn't that easy, because sometimes just going on as if nothing happened and everything is normal, and then that's something that's a bit difficult to do.
Shai, has it been easy for you?
It wasn't easy, but it was very educating and a very learning experience. That's for sure. I got a lot of good friends and bond with a lot of people. And in this kind of a stressful situation, you find out a lot of things about yourself, which is it is a great experience. But being today, it seems hard to look back and think that will I do that again right now.
Shai, thanks very much for the call. Appreciate it.
Thank you.
Bye-bye. Let's talk with Jack. Jack's calling us from Miami in Florida.
Yes, well, thank you for having me on your show. Fortunately, I disagree with most of the guests and speakers that I've listened to the past minute. I feel extremely proud to have been served in a as a captain in a special unit, infantry special unit in the IDF. I feel that after 60 years of being hated and being violented by our neighbors, we had no choice but to defend ourselves. And we do it with pride, and we do it with the top humanitarian, the top morale standards that you've ever seen. I could talk all of your show right now and more about different stories in the territories, in Lebanon, in Gaza, where you had heartbreaking people. And it's always, war is always sufferment, so it's always sad to see these people suffering, but it's encouraging when you come, when you see them coming to you and thanking you for helping them in the long term. Their regimes are completely corrupt, and believe it or not, what we do there is saving them. We do it sometimes at the expense of our own lives. I'll give you one little episode which I attended in Jenin. We had a terrible, we knew that it was a minefield of bombs and of snipers waiting for us, and yet the Israeli Defense Forces, with its highest standard of morality, like always, decided to put at risk its own soldiers and go inside by foot instead of doing what a lot of other Western armies, like the U.S., for example, just to name another, did in Afghanistan, which is just basically giving them flyers saying, listen, leave out this area by 12 tomorrow. If not, you'll be bombed. And maybe just go into it from air. The IDF risks their people at the expense of... it puts top priority on morals and on being as decent as it can while putting at risk its own people. So it's really sad to hear people having such a bad experience. I think most of your hosts right now and the guests that have spoken are clearly left, super left wing, which is something right now trendy in Israel. But the bulk of us are proud of the IDF. They're proud of our state, and we wish the IDF and the State of Israel a happy 60th anniversary.
Jeffrey?
Look, he's absolutely right on one point. In Jenin, which is a famous episode, the Israelis obviously could have bombed Jenin from the air. It would have been easier. It would have saved Israeli lives. They didn't. They sent troops in to clear out these bomb factories. 23 troops died. 55 Palestinians died. Clearly, the Israelis made the tough choice there, and the army was criticized for it. But I think that the caller isn't recognizing some complexities here. I mean, just from my own experience, I've seen soldiers give mouth-to-mouth resuscitation in two examples to Hamas terrorists in order to save their lives. In other cases, I've seen soldiers beat up people at checkpoints for no reason. So it's impossible to generalize here and say that all Israelis are behaving in an exemplary way. All Israelis are behaving in a horrible way. I think on balance, most Israelis in the army are trying to grapple with the difficult situation they've been put in by their state when they're occupying these people. But I don't like the oversimplification of the left or the right in these debates.
Tamar Yaron, I wanted to hear you on this.
Yeah, I also can strengthen some of the caller's words about the standard that the IDF is trying to abide by. I mean, there's a department in the army that is called the Ethical Department, and that is dealing with the values. That's what it does. And this department is in contact with me about using my film to educate the soldiers and to show them what can happen to you, how you can go astray, and to try to keep some moral standards in this situation. So it is very true that there is a true attempt, I think, of the army to try to be as moral as possible in this situation. The sad bit is that I think it is it's a bit this thing of a Sisyphus thing, that it's I really think that you can try to narrow as much as possible the bad stories that you hear, but at the end of the day, the situation is, it's impossible to come out of it and be moral in it. I mean, these are people that they don't have basic rights, so and you're controlling these people. So you can do it as gently as possible and try to do it as morally as possible, but there's something about the situation that is problematic from the beginning.
Jack? Yes, go ahead.
Yes, I just wanted to mention one thing. It's clearly what happens there and what you see in the TV stations in CNN and around the world are two different things. First of all, the media, sadly, and today, the terrorism's number one weapon is the media, and they use it very wisely. What you see there is different, but even if we could be a little more punctual in reporting what is happening in the field, I'll leave you with this food for thought. Even if we are, and I believe we are right in doing what we're doing, and we're doing it in a very moral way, but it's very difficult to convince the world of anything else when you see a picture of the Israeli Merkava tank against a Palestinian boy that is throwing the stone. That picture is more than 1,000 words, and it's very difficult to compete against it. But the truth is, and we saw a little bit of that with Reuters and with all these news media stations that were reporting and were changing, were using Photoshop to change things. That picture is a very clear picture, but what really is difficult telling is the story behind it. It's difficult to tell people how this little boy is there with the stone, not because it's his last resource, but because these terrorists, inspired by the Hamas government, are putting him there so that, A, the media can see this picture and criticize Israel, B, the Israelis will not be able to fire back because, you know, I was just talking about the standards we have. We're not going to fire at an innocent civilian and a boy. So it's a pretty complex situation. Just have that in mind when you're analyzing the situation by views of CNN and other news media.
Jack, thanks very much for the call. Tamar Yarom, thank you so much for your time today.
Thank you.
Tamar Yarom is the director of the award-winning documentary To See If I'm Smiling about women soldiers serving in the Israeli Defense Forces. She joined us from Jerusalem Capital Studios in Tel Aviv, and you're listening to Talk of the Nation from NPR News. And Jeffrey Goldberg, we've asked you to stay along a little bit longer with us. Of course, in addition to serving in the IDF, you have worked as a reporter covering Israel, and you've written extensively in The Atlantic about Israel and its 60th birthday and the conundrum it currently faces. And one of the interesting things you wrote about in your piece was a conclusion you wrote that in many ways the most successful national liberation struggle of the 20th century was in Israel, and in a way the worst national liberation struggle, the least successful, was the Palestinians.
Right. The it's important. And look, I succumb to the let's say the Jewish predisposition toward dissatisfaction and complaint. A lot of us look at Israel and look at the flaws. It is. At the 60th anniversary, it's worth noting that it is an astonishing success. This is an idea that began in the head of a Viennese journalist named Theodor Herzl a little more than 100 years ago. He decided that the answer to anti-Semitism was to have a Jewish state. Today, there's this Jewish state with 6 million Jews, a GDP of $150 billion a year, science and industry and universities. It defends itself, sometimes imperfectly, but it defends itself. So it is a remarkable, remarkable story. The Palestinians represent one of the least successful national liberation movement. I'm not talking on moral level or ethical level. I'm talking about the ability to actually get what you say you want. The secret, I think, one of the secrets is that the Zionist movement was always realistic about what it could get at particular moments. David Ben-Gurion didn't want to take the UN partition plan in 1948. It wasn't ideal, but he said this is better than nothing. I think the problem in Palestinian politics is a desire to achieve perfect justice or the perfect solution. Of course, if you pursue the perfect solution, you're not going to get any solution.
The good is the enemy of the perfect.
The good is the enemy of the perfect, and that's certainly true in Middle East politics.
And as you look at your experience in the IDF and that of your fellow soldiers, how does that experience shape Israel, do you think? I mean, this is 60 years now.
How does it shape Israel?
Yeah.
It's interesting and multifaceted. I think one of the extraordinary things about Israel is the level of engagement the average citizen has with his state. Here, we pay taxes, we vote, we serve on juries. Sometimes we vote, sometimes we go to jury duty. There, you're expected to put your life on the line in a regular way, and therefore politics is visceral in a way that it's not here, because the decisions that politicians make will affect whether your child lives or dies in his army service, and so there's a such a high level of civic engagement. I think, very briefly, that the service in the territories has helped Israel try to grapple with the dilemma of the Palestinians. People don't want to send their kids there to serve in the army, and so some people are demanding some sort of change.
We'll talk about the implications of that and more with Jeffrey Goldberg when we come back. Stay with us. I'm Neil Conan. You're listening to Talk of the Nation from NPR News. In a few minutes, it'll be time for the Talk of the Nation opinion page. We'll talk about U.S. intelligence and the conclusion that it may, after the mistakes of Iraq, be too cautious on Syria and Iran. But let's continue our conversation with Jeffrey Goldberg on the 60th anniversary of the State of Israel. And one of the conclusions, Jeffrey, that you ask about in your article in The Atlantic Monthly, that is that despite that enormous success as a nation that you just described just a few minutes ago, that there are still questions about Israel's legitimacy that are not limited to the states outside of Israel.
Right. That's a fascinating point. I think that, that 60 years later, there are still existential questions about Israel that you don't have about other countries. Much of that is derived from external sources. When you have the president of a major Middle Eastern power, Iran, threatening regularly to wipe Israel off the map, obviously you're going to have to grapple with existential problems. One of the existential problems I was dealing with in this story is an internal one, which is what to do about the territories we were just talking about. Let the Palestinians have a viable Palestinian state, and is that in the best interest of Israel? It's obviously in the best interest of the Palestinians. I argue that at this point, demographically, if for no other reason, that the Palestinians have to be set free, if you will, or given their independence, because if they're not, and Israel finds itself in control of them for another 40 years, I think the dream of a Jewish democratic state disappears. Israel can't expel them. That's immoral. Israel also doesn't want to give the Palestinians of the West Bank citizenship, because that means the end of a Jewish homeland. It means a binational state, and we know from experience that binational states don't work. They barely works in Belgium in the middle of Europe, so it's hard to imagine it working in the Middle East. So Israel is confronted with some decisions about the West Bank and Gaza, and these decisions, of course, are made much more difficult by the fact that many of Israel's enemies want to erase the entirety of Israel, not just remove Israel from the occupied territories.
And that Israeli leaders, indeed the Israeli public, that engagement in politics you talked about earlier, faces a sort of paralysis.
The problem is so difficult, and politics is so fractious in Israel that you do have a paralysis. One of the things Israel lacks right now is strong political leadership. You know, we all would like to believe that assassins can't change the course of history. But I believe that the assassin of Yitzhak Rabin probably did change the course of history. There is no Yitzhak Rabin. Nobody who can convince the Israelis to make these hard and dangerous steps necessary to guarantee Israel's overarching safety for the future. So you have a leadership crisis. And you also have a situation, a very specific situation, in which Israel 3 years ago did pull out of the Gaza Strip. It pulled its settlers out, and it pulled its soldiers out. The hope was that the Palestinians would turn Gaza into a nascent Palestinian state, a moderate state that could trade with Israel. Instead, Hamas takes over that piece of territory and starts firing rockets into Israel. So from the average Israeli's perspective, the thought of turning over the West Bank, which is much closer to the heart of Israel, it's 3 miles from the main airport, is a thought that creates paralysis.
Jeffrey Goldberg, thanks very much for your time today. Appreciate it.
Thank you.
Jeffrey Goldberg is a national correspondent for The Atlantic and also the author of Prisoners, A Story of Friendship and Terror, about his experiences in the IDF, the Israeli Defense Forces, back in the First Intifada. He joined us here in Studio 3A. The opinion page coming up.